You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Good afternoon, Alan. How are you doing on this sunny Wednesday?
It's finally fine. Yes, I'm doing very well. Thank
you,
Shamina.
It's bloody beautiful, isn't it? So, first story today, we'll just boost through because we've got some more water coverage to go on to after the show, and we notoriously just talk on Dear Science. But today, sticking to the points, forget fake news is our first story. The bigger problem in science is PR hype. Can you tell me about this?
Okay, so how do people find out about the big discoveries in science? It's generally through the media. And the big problem with that is that journalists are not scientists and scientists are not journalists. So somehow you've got to meet in the middle somewhere, and the scientists have got to communicate their results in an understandable language to the journalists, who then pass it on to the general public. So they do this generally in the form of press releases, and those are designed for, you know, easy consumption by the media, who can then go and write it in their newspapers and report it on their radio stations and TV and stuff like that. So in 2014, the British Medical Journal did a study of 462 press releases from leading UK health institutions. And what they found was that 40% of those press releases contained health advice that was more explicit than anything found in the article. So in other words, they were hyping it up. A third emphasized possible cause and effects when the paper merely reported correlations. So again, hyping it up. And a third, studies of cells or animals sort of overinflated the relevance to humans. So, sadly, that's a problem with press releases. And recently, sort of this month, in fact, there was a press release from a place called the Victor Chang Cardiac Research Institute, and they are in Oz. And I'm going to read you some phrases from this press release to, and I guess let your listeners see what they make of this. So the title is "Historic Discovery Promises to Prevent Miscarriages and Birth Defects Globally." Okay, that's quite a big...
That's a big claim.
That is a big claim, okay?
Making a big call.
So they say in the press release, this is one of the greatest discoveries in pregnancy research. They say that vitamin B3 can cure molecular deficiencies, which are called miscarriages and birth defects, and cure is italicized, very important word, cure, okay? Findings expected to change the way pregnant women are cared for. It's blockbuster. It's expected to prevent miscarriages and multiple types of birth defects. It's a remarkably simple cure. It's a historic discovery among Australia's greatest ever medical breakthroughs. It'll forever change the way pregnant women are cared for around the globe. If we had time, I would go on. Okay,
wow.
But the entire press release is like this, okay? It's about 4 pages long, and it utilizes that language all the way through. Now, there's been a bit of controversy over this, because on page 3 of the press release, after all of this wow, we get to the sentence, using a preclinical mouse model, scientists at the Victor Chang Institute investigated the effect of vitamin B3 on developing embryos. The results were astounding. You know, there's another word there. But they mention mice once in this press release, okay? You go and read the study is of mice, okay? And what they were looking at was essentially the effect of a deficit of vitamin B3 on mouse embryos, okay? Not pregnant women, pregnant mice. And they say they've been going at this for 12 years, and that the guts of the research is that pregnant women should supplement with vitamin B3 to prevent miscarriages and birth defects.
Surely that the PR department of a university or whatever needs to check these things off with the researcher, seeing as they're putting this press release to this researcher's name.
Yep.
And it's in the researcher's best interest for it to be accurate.
And the researcher is quoted quite extensively through the press release. The ramifications are likely to be huge. This has the potential to significantly reduce the number of miscarriages and birth defects around the world, and I do not use those words lightly, says Prof Dunwoody. So, you know, those are her words.
Wow.
So she's hyping it up. The Institute is hyping it up. It's hyped up beyond all possible hype, okay? And as I say, it's to do with mice. It's not to do with pregnant women. So, is this going to change the way that pregnancy is treated, or for want of a better word, you know, in the Western world? And the answer is no. Okay. Mm. Now, this was picked up very quickly, thankfully, and the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists, they released a statement, and in part saying it's premature to claim a medical breakthrough, and they also said that without further controlled studies, the claim has potential to do more harm than good. And they're absolutely right. So you've got to ask the question, why do people do this? Why are press releases, scientific press releases, overhyped?
I feel like this, though, is an extreme case. Because, I get science press releases all of the time, and I don't think I've ever read one like that.
Yeah. No, this is just totally
over the top. And if I did, I would, you know, bin it or something, because I feel like that language is just inherently suspicious, and I would just disregard it completely.
Absolutely. As soon as you see the word cure in any medical press release, then you just know perhaps to treat it with...
caution.
Yeah. Oh, great caution. So why do they do this? Well... this place is Victor Chang Institute, so it's a private institution, so they're relying on funding from, you know, I don't know, the private sector presumably, probably the public sector as well. They'll be in for grants and stuff like that, so they've got to make the big discoveries in order to get the big grants. So funding could be one reason. Publicity, get themselves in the media, I guess, and so people will then know about them. They're not a university institution, so they're not as well known, obviously, as the universities in Australia. Or, dare I say it, it could just be ego. You know, somebody thinks they've made this amazing discovery and they want the world to know. And that, I mean, all three reasons are really, really, really sad if those are the actual reasons why they did that, or one of those three. So this is the way that the whole measles, mumps, rubella vaccine thing and Andrew Wakefield started. That, likewise, was an overhyped press release where the facts were not... outlined in the press release itself.
And then it kind of took on a life of its own.
Absolutely, yes. And then you saw the damage that caused. And, you know, this British Medical Journal study saying that 40% of the press releases overhype the research. I mean, I think the publicity people in these institutions need to take a long, long, hard look at themselves. And, you know, again, as soon as you mention a cure, you often see press releases say, you know, this might be eventually a cure for blah, blah, blah. What they don't say is, oh, yeah, but it's going to be 20 years down the track or whatever. You know, this is just the preliminary research. You don't find a cure overnight. And so this is just very, very, very wrong. Now, in the interim, I guess due to the publicity, the Victor Chang Institute have gone and sort of put an addendum to this press release, where they're sort of saying, well, we never said that it was going to be a cure or whatever, but, you know, you can't really have it both ways. So, there need to be perhaps more people who can understand the science and who can report the science to the media in a sensible fashion and not an overhyped fashion. They've got to realise the limitations of these things, for goodness sake, you know.
So people like Peter Griffin, who wrote that
absolutely
article that he sent me about who runs the Science Media Centre.
And that's exactly what he does, and he's a shining light, you know. He's a really great servant of science, that fella, so yeah.
Yep. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And so our next story today... looks at how avocados might be damaging to carriers of breast cancer, of the breast cancer gene.
And yes.
Which I read, what was it, the Angelina Jolie gene?
The Angelina Jolie gene, as it's been called, the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene. Now, I read the story and it was titled, Study Finds Avocado Damaging to Carriers of Breast Cancer Gene. So those were the headlines in the Herald on last Friday. And so from that, you would think that, well, and again, just sort of reading the intro, research published in Nature, so it's in Nature, so it's, you know, it's good stuff. That's the best journal there is. It suggests that eating foods high in folate, such as avocado, asparagus, and broccoli, can increase cancer risk in women carrying the mutant BRCA genes, okay? And that's not what it said at all. I've gone and read the paper, and it's completely the opposite. This is terrible. So it really sort of relates back to the first story
very nicely. When I looked at it this morning, and in the first line it said, reported by, the Daily Mail in the
UK?
Yes,
I know. And as soon as you see that,
why is Alan sending me this story?
I know.
But, now it makes sense that you're let's criticise this.
Yes, I saw someone on TV last night calling it the Daily Bigot, I think, but yeah. So really, that's not what the study says at all. The study, in fact, says the complete opposite, that they've done this study with folate, otherwise known as vitamin B9. And remember, we had this big debate a few years ago about whether you should be able to fortify bread with folic acid to prevent neural tube defects in newborns. And I always said that they shouldn't have called it folic acid, they should have called it vitamin B9, because who's going to argue against putting vitamins in a bread, you know? So,
right.
And so these guys were studying this, and they found that the decomposition of folate leads to a thing called formaldehyde, which I'm sure you've all heard of. It's a nasty little molecule. It's known for quite some time. It's been known that you can form formaldehyde in the body somehow, but they didn't know exactly how. So now they've figured it out. It comes from the decomposition of folate. And in fact, what this then allows them to do is they think that supplementation with tetrahydrofolate, which is a derivative of folate, could allow you then to kill these mutant cancer cells. Okay, so it's a possible method of treatment of cancer, for goodness sake, not actually giving you cancer. So if I were the avocado growers and broccoli growers around the place, I'd be pretty pissed off by this. And I really think they might want to go and read that study carefully, or get, you know, somebody who knows about it to explain it and see exactly what it says. Because from what I can make of it, it's definitely not what the headline says. So
this all comes under the idea of publishing things too early. I mean, they've published this and they're like, oh, it could be one thing or it could be the other. Who really knows? And they've come up with some ideas.
Well, what they've done is come up with this definite way of which formaldehyde is formed in the body. That's the big study. That's the big result of the study, is they've found how now formaldehyde gets into the body. Okay? And then they're proposing that they can then target these cancer cells, essentially using the formaldehyde to knock them out now. And so it's a potential treatment for cancer, and particularly with this BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutant genes. So I really think, those are the perils of reprinting from the Daily Mail, possibly.
And I mean, I guess it just goes back to that wider issue that we were talking about with the first story, is
very
that this
so.
Very complex relationship between science and the media, and how a lot of those intermediary players possibly... You know, well, it's not that they have more responsibility, but it's just communication between all ends of that communication line. It needs to be clear, and because then it results in things like this.
Absolutely, and I think the big problem is that there's very few absolutes in science.
Right,
very few. People want things to be black and white. They want a cure or whatever.
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't work that way. Science is fuzzy. It's not necessarily certain, but you know, we do the best that we can. So and people need to understand that, and particularly the people who report it.
So in the interests of not saying this next story as an absolute, scientists reveal why whiskey might taste better with water.
You did that absolutely perfectly.
Oh,
and in fact, that's what it says in the paper as well.
Oh,
okay.
Great.
So they did couch their language saying that dilution with water should, I believe, make it taste better. Okay. So whiskey is basically mostly water, quite a bit of alcohol, ethanol, and a few other flavor compounds, okay? And it's the flavor compounds that are the important thing. And so those are the things that you smell when you put it up to your nose. Those are the things that you taste. So the ethanol and the water are just, you know, there to carry them along. So the question then comes, do you have your whiskey with water or do you have it straight? Do you have it neat? And so these two scientists in Sweden, decided to do a study on this, but what they didn't do was do a taste test. And what they did do was they worked this out using a computer, okay? which might seem a bit of a strange thing to do, but taste tests are very subjective things. Mm. Very, very subjective. You can't argue with a computer. So what they did was they modelled water and ethanol and one of these flavour compounds called guaiacol, which comes from the burnt oak barrels that they used to age the whiskies in, okay? And that's a relatively simple molecule. And what they did first was to put into the computer a mixture, not literally, but put into the computer a mixture of water and ethanol, and it told the computer to sort out the most favourable arrangement of all the molecules there, okay? And it so happens that one end of ethanol really, really likes water molecules, and the other end doesn't. And this leads to the ethanol going preferentially to the top, okay? So it's at the interface between the liquid and the air. And so it's actually a heterogeneous mixture. It's not a homogeneous mixture, as you might expect. And then when you start adding the guaiacol, the flavor compounds, they associate preferentially with the ethanol. And the ethanol's at the interface. And the interface is where you want your flavor compounds to be, because that's where you're going to get evaporation. That's where you're going to get the aroma from. That's where you're going to get the taste from. And what they then found was, as they increased the ethanol content up to about above 50, 59%, then the guaiacol, the flavour compounds, went into the middle of the mixture, okay, into the interior, making them less available to be smelt, to be tasted, etc., etc. So these guys are saying that the optimum water content for whiskey should be sort of around about 20, 25%, something like that. And I don't know, what are your whiskey alcohol contents? About 45, something like that. There or thereabouts. The boys are nodding. So.
Why don't you just look to the boys?
I honestly don't know, but I feel pressure to say yes.
You don't even know. Maybe I'm a whiskey connoisseur.
Okay, Shamita, are you a whiskey connoisseur?
No, I'm not. No. just so you're aware.
I'm sorry. There we go. My bad.
Okay. Whiskey is not gendered.
Anyway, as you were, Alan.
I'll just skulk away now. What was I saying? Oh, right. Okay, so, yeah. So as you get to about 20, 25% water content, alcohol content, sorry, not water content, then it should taste better, because those flavour molecules are going to be the interface, they're going to be the edges of the whiskey, and so more available to taste, more available to smell. Now, as I said, this was all done on a computer, wasn't done with a taste test, but it would be interesting now to go and do a taste test, obviously, and see if you can match the subjective with the objective.
Yeah, and see if that sort of corroborates what the computer told us.
And you must remember, obviously, that they're not using all the flavour compounds, they're just using a single flavour compound, but this is sort of one of the most concentrated compounds that are in the whiskey, so in the highest concentration. So it's kind of interesting, a nice wee study, and it got published in a good journal. So.
Maybe we can do that live on the show next week.
I reckon.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, taste testing.
Whiskey taste test live on the show next week. Well, we'll see what we can do. But anyway, thank you for coming in today, Alan. We'll talk to you again then.
Okay, thanks, Shamina.
Bye.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.